Well, welcome everyone to this edition of Our Outside You. I'm your host, Helen Harrell, and I'm excited about talking with my guest today, Stuart Rosenberg, who is an owner and partner in Superior Blue Strategies. As well as having done a lot of things politically, we should say in the past, he was campaign manager for Indiana Senator J.D. Ford, and he's been a field director for Tammy Baldwin, and he was the field director for HRC. I met Stuart a few years ago when he was here in Indiana for, I think it was the marriage bill, if I am correct. But anyway, welcome to Our Outside View, Stuart.
Can we do this again?
Do what again?
We got a bunch of facts wrong. Can we retape?
Sure, I guess we can. Yeah. What are the facts wrong? I got this off of your Facebook, so.
Oh, so I did some of the TV for J.D. Ford. And it's Foundation Blue Media now.
Uh-huh.
That's it.
Okay, well, that's fine. Listeners can get that. That's fine. But what is Superior Blue Strategies exactly?
So I work for Foundation Blue Media. Foundation Blue Media is a paid media firm that helps Democrats and progressives get elected to office. So we do things like digital advertising, television advertising, radio advertising for Democrats, and we focus on making sure we get to know their personal stories and that their personal stories come out instead of trying to be all factual with it's not that we don't want to be factual, but as Democrats we sometimes are afraid to explain our why. In other words, why is it we want to run for office? Why is it we think we can make a difference for people? We often want to just get bogged down into the facts, but we never actually try to explain emotionally why we're involved. And our firm tries to make sure we speak from the heart before we speak from the brain, instead of trying to be too intellectualized and not actually try to connect with people.
Well, do you think it's at all, I mean, I know that Democrats, a lot of Democrats, and I guess I'm one. I used to be an independent, but I had to register in Indiana as Democrat or Republican. So, of course, I went Democrat. But I tend to be kind of far left of Democrat, I think, most of the time. But do you think Democrats are a little bit, in certain parts of the country, a little bit smug? And that's why they don't explain, like we're right. We know we're right. And we're on the, you know, we're on the right side of things. And so we don't have to explain.
I think, yes, it's not intentional.
Right.
But exactly. There's a belief that the way to connect with people is by proving you're right and you're smarter, instead of trying to relate to people by showing why you've decided to be involved and why you care. And there is a vulnerability in describing who you actually are and why you care. But that vulnerability allows a connection much better than just trying to prove you're the smartest person in the room and that you're right and somebody else is wrong.
Yeah, that makes sense. Exactly. It makes sense. I know this area, I'm not from here. Actually, you and I have a background in common. We're both from Wisconsin.
Yep.
A Green Bay Packer fan here, always will be.
Good.
In Indiana, for example, I mean, it's a red state. It's Republican pretty much. And the area that I'm in Bloomington is probably the most liberal area. And if you can call it that, because it's still very conservative, in my opinion. But I do see that pattern in Democrats here, in particular in Bloomington, is that they're just very, you know, very self-confident about we're right and we're going to do it this way. And we don't have to tell you why, or we don't have to be transparent about our reasons. And I think that can be very hurtful and harmful.
It can be very hurtful. And it goes even deeper than just saying, I know I'm right, so I don't need to explain why I'm right. But we don't explain why this matters to us personally. And so as a result, it sounds very empty rhetoric. I mean, that's not exactly a word, but it sounds very empty when it says, this is right and this is what we need to do. Well, voters have heard that from Democrats and from Republicans, cycle after cycle. They've heard
Sure.
the talking points over and over again, but they don't understand. They don't know why the person using the talking point, whether a Democrat or a Republican, actually genuinely cares about the talking point. They just say the talking point. And after
Exactly.
a while, it just gets exhausting as a voter to hear the same talking point over and over again without an authenticity to show that you actually are truly committed to the issue that was the origination of that talking point.
I think one of the things that even on both sides, a lot of politicians fall short in is, they like you're saying talking points, but I want to know how. Like, if you tell me you're going to fix an amendment, or you're going to fix the budget, or you're going to help with a certain law or a certain process in something, or something that people are upset about, how are you going to do it? What are you going to do? What are your plans? Give me an ABC step program that tells me, that outlines, how we're going to get there.
Well, the how matters as well, but it all comes down to authenticity. If the person doesn't believe you in the first place and believe that you truly care about this issue in the first place, they're not going to believe your what, and they're not going to believe your how. They're not going to believe either one of them because you've already lost them. They've already decided this is not somebody who understands me and truly cares about me. Like, for example, you mentioned how we work together to help kill the anti-marriage amendment in Indiana. And I would tell a story about why this mattered to me. And I remember why it mattered to me. Because when I was 10 years old, my mom went to law school. And I grew up with a very traditional mother starting at 10 years old. His name is Neil Rosenberg. And I grew up with a very traditional mother starting at, yes, very traditional father at 10 years old. Her name was Susan Rosenberg. And my dad did the cooking and the cleaning and the grocery shopping and picked the kids up from school. And my mom became a trial lawyer when I was 13 years old in 1984. And let me tell you something. I'm not saying it's easy to be a female trial lawyer now, but in 1984, it sure as heck wasn't.
No, exactly.
I'm a white heterosexual male. I have all the privilege in the world, but the stories we would hear from my mom of what she was dealing with was unbelievable. But I have some good news for you. I'm not sure I can say this on your program. She castrated those bastards. And she
I understand exactly what you mean.
whole bunch of money. And my dad in his 50s gave a toast at the newspaper where he was a reporter. And he said, to all of you who are going to report the news still, who are going to inform the public, thank you for your public service. I only have one more thing to say, and I won't use the swear words for it. The heck with you. I now get to spend my wife's money. And you know what I learned from that story and what I learned from that experience? My mom didn't do well for female lawyers. My mom did well for our family. She did well for all of us. And I learned from my mom that when we all do well, we all do well. And so when I was given an opportunity to run the campaign in Massachusetts that broke the tie to keep the anti-marriage amendment off the ballot in 2005, I took that lesson I took from my parents that they taught me, which is this wasn't about gay marriage. This wasn't something that was going to help LGBTQ people, but do no good for me. Equality was going to do well for all of us, including me, a heterosexual male. And that given this opportunity to run this campaign, of course I was going to do it. And when we won, and the Human Rights Campaign called me, and they said, we'd like to hire you. I said, well, I'm not gay. And they said, 10% ain't 50%. We need more of you to help win. And it didn't even strike my mind as being strange that they wanted to hire me, again, because of how I was raised. So of course I did it. But I think you saw an authenticity with me when we were working together in Indiana, that I truly cared. And until you saw that I truly cared, you weren't going to work with me on this issue. You didn't care what how I told you about how we were going to win or what we were going to do or any of those things, unless you first believed that I actually cared about this in the first place. And then you believed that I actually cared for your opinion in deciding what and the how would be. And that's my point of, I think, what we need to do as Democrats more. Is we need to explain our why. and so that people know that we authentically care before we even talk about the what or the how. Otherwise, we never get their attention on the what and how.
Well, I think that's an excellent point. I think getting people's attention and holding their attention, but how do you convince people that are like just totally polar opposite? They can see that you're committed. They can see that you're sincere. They can see that you, really care about what you're doing and what you believe, but they're just never ever going to accept what you have to say. They're not going to see things the way you do.
You don't bother. In other words,
Well,
you don't bother. And what I mean by that is you're never going to convince all the people all the time. The question becomes, what do you need to do to be successful? How many people do you need to convince? How many votes do you need? How many dollars do you need? How many hours do you need? Whatever it is you're trying to achieve in the campaign you're pursuing, whether it's political or not political. You have a plan and you know how to get there. And the plan never should be you need to convince everybody. Because if you try to convince everybody, there's never enough of the three scarcities to allow yourself to convince everybody. The three scarcities are time, money, and people. And there's one that you can never get more of, no matter how hard you try, which is time. So if you're spending your time on people who you're never going to be able to convince, and that's causing you to not have enough time to convince the people you could convince in order to be successful, then you shouldn't be trying to convince the people you can't convince.
well, as you know, I'm sure you're more than aware, the status of our country right now, the division, the really disastrous, in my opinion, the disastrous administration we have right now. And I am someone who actually did associate somewhat with Trump's crowd many years ago. I'm a lot older than you, by the way. And I see things a little differently in the time frame of what's transpired in our country, but I don't think I've ever seen anything as disastrous. And I mean, I lived through the 50s with the McCarthy era and the anti-communist, the big fear and panic about that. And where do we go from here? What do you see? What are you doing right now? And who are you going to be working with to try and make changes? I know it's in, one area at a time. We can only affect one election here and one election there. But what are you doing in particular
Well,
and focusing on?
this is why I mentioned what the name of the firm is. It's called Foundation Blue Media. The where isn't necessarily a state or a region. It's the type of office we're focusing on. And it's the foundation for changing things in America. And the foundation for our changing in America in an electoral sense is municipal and state legislative races. That's where people's lives are impacted more on a day-to-day basis than any other level of government. And we often, as Democrats, have gotten so focused on Congress and Senate and president that as a result, we've lost people on the local level. Indiana in 2006 had a majority state house. It's now in the super minority as of 2019 in the state house. And so, if you want to control things on the federal level, I would say it can be any municipal office, anywhere. And even if it's a municipal office where it's 90% Republican, if you get 20% of the vote instead of 10% of the vote in a municipal office, that's 10% more people who are now engaged in the electoral process that may end up voting in an election where maybe their municipality isn't the difference in the election, but their extra 10% makes the difference in a larger race as well. So I would say start at the municipal level, start at the local level, start at the state legislative level, start at the foundation of democracy. Don't start all the way at the top, start at the foundation. And that's how
Which
I think you can move things in our country.
is pretty much grassroots organizing, correct?
Exactly. Because you can
Well,
do grassroots organizing. You can do grassroots organizing on a national level. You can do it on a state level. But if you've built the foundation on the local level, where it's easier to do, When I say easier, I don't mean to say it's easy, but it's easier,
Right.
meaning you can knock on every door in a municipality. You can go to every public function in a municipality. Now, I mean, I say this assuming the municipality is not New York City, obviously, but you get my point is you can interact with people face to face, handshake to handshake, easier on the local level, and then it grows from there than trying to do it starting at the national level and working down. And so get to know your neighbors. Have potluck dinners. Have these conversations that aren't always comfortable with the people who you know and you interact with every day. And that's how you have to make change.
You know, one of the things that I find that I've observed in Indiana, here in Bloomington, and we're in Monroe County, is that probably the population of Bloomington, of course, if you include the students, is somewhere around 85,000. And when they leave, or maybe it's even more than that now, but when they leave, it's around 70,000, 65,000. And when we have elections here, there are like 5,000 and 6,000 people that vote, and that's it.
Absolutely true.
There is something seriously wrong. And I know that, and that, you know, it's almost always, and of course, I tend to agree, well, a great deal with most of the people that are elected, because they tend to be Democrats. We have very few Republicans that step forward and run. And I know that the county itself is probably more Republican than it is Democrat. So how do you approach turning that around when you have a situation that seems so biased?
So engagement needs to be looked at more broadly to begin with. In other words, people may not be voting, but there's ways to engage them in civic discourse in a way that they may get more engaged. And through that engagement, that voting may increase over time. It may not happen immediately. It takes a while. And if you look at your engagement as solely towards in an electoral sense, sort of is, I'm doing this because there's an election this November, what inevitably happens is once November happens, everyone stops the engagement for months at a time. They just stop. And then they do it all over again 3 months before the next election. But if you look at the purpose of engagement as doing it every week, every month, every year, regardless of where an election is, over time, it will then affect the number of people who vote in elections. Instead of starting at looking at our goal is 5,000 people voted this time, let's make it 6,000 next time. I'm saying there are issues all the time that affect us in Bloomington, Indiana, or wherever we live and work and play. And there's no reason why we can't help build that engagement throughout. Let me give you an example of this. It's intriguing. I argue there's only one American in all of America who has been successful in regularly increasing the Latino vote output in elections. Only one in all of America. Take a guess who that is. You'll never guess.
I don't know. Maybe the president.
Nope. His name's Harry Reid.
Harry Reid. Okay.
Former senator of Nevada.
Oh, yes.
In 2008, he moved the presidential caucuses, the primary caucuses, whatever you want to call them, from 42nd out of the 50 states to third. And caucuses are super local type things. Right? That involves grassroots organizing. And guess what happened? Nevada suddenly mattered in the 2008 primaries and caucuses. And all these, and guess what? 25% of the population of Nevada is Latino. Many of them vote Democratic. Suddenly, there was outreach happening in the Latino communities other than the last 2 months of a November election. A whole bunch of it. And Latinos came out in droves for these caucuses. Then Harry Reid did something even crazier. He didn't stop. The organization kept on growing in outreach to Latino neighborhoods, not just about voting, about any and any issue that was affecting Latino neighborhoods. There was an organization in place to make sure that there was engagement in working with the Latino population. And mind you, not all Latinos are the same. So there's different issues for different Latino populations. all over the place in Nevada, and there was this constant engagement. So 2008 happens. Barack Obama wins Nevada. John Kerry lost Nevada. Al Gore lost Nevada. Nevada was not a blue state. 2008, he wins Nevada. Harry Reid's up for election in 2010. He doesn't stop. On the local community level, community to community, still full engagement. Not even talking about elections. No discussion about elections at all. Whatever the issues were that are of interest to different Latino populations in different areas in Nevada, whatever they were, Harry Reid's organization was engaged with them. He ran in 2010 for U.S. Senate re-election, which you might remember was a horrible year for Democrats.
Yes.
And he won. And then he did something even crazier. He still didn't stop. And he's still engaged. And in 2010, the House and the Senate of Nevada were in Republican supermajorities. It's now 2018. They're in Democratic supermajorities. And it didn't happen overnight. It took 10 years. But Harry Reid did not engage, and his organization did not engage with Latino organizations and individuals and neighborhoods, just focused on elections. It was on all the issues that the Latino neighborhoods and communities said were important to them for government to be engaged in, that caused the side effect, if you want to call it that, of increased turnout and votes. And now the Latino population votes heavily in Nevada compared to almost anywhere else in America. In fact, I will put my bottom dollar on it. The Latino vote in Nevada by percentage compared to registration, I bet, is higher than anywhere else in the United States of America.
Well, let me clarify one thing. The reason I said the president was because sometimes his negativity, I think, aligns people and you
oh, yeah.
in opposition, but that's not the way to go. What you just said here demonstrates to me, it kind of clarifies something to me about the local community here, is that perhaps they're not reaching out to anybody but themselves.
Oh, that's a huge problem in politics, Democrats and Republican. Imagine you had a pyramid. The one percenters are the chattering class. And if a candidate, a cause, an issue, an organization decides they're going to determine their plans and strategies based on the chattering class, you'll never get past first base. Because the chattering class is insatiable. There's nothing you can do to fully satisfy the chattering class. And the chattering class doesn't interact with the general population. For example, in a campaign, and let's say it's a municipal race, I ask this question of all my candidates. I say, if you have to choose between going to your municipal Democratic committee meeting or you're invited by the Little League commissioner to the Little League banquet, which should you go to? They all answer the Little League banquet. And then I say, great, which are you going to get more garbage from for not going? And they said, the Democratic Committee. I said, yep. And so my response is, get used to it. If you let all the hating from the chattering class cause you to change your plan to try to appease the chattering class, you will not only never appease the chattering class, but you'll actually never talk to the people who actually are going to matter in achieving your cause, your purpose, your election, whatever the case may be. And yet many, many, many elected officials and people in government or people who want to run for government respond to the chattering class exclusively and almost exclusively and then wonder why things aren't going well. It's because you're not talking to regular people. And I don't mean regular people pejoratively. I mean talking about people who don't live and breathe politics.
Right. That's always made perfect sense to me. I see also the chattering class, as you call them here. People don't want anybody from the outside. They don't want anybody different coming in and telling them anything. And it's very hard to break through, say, well, we need to do this. I mean, you know the community here, and it's a small Latino population, a small Black population. It's a majority white and has been run majority by white males. But now that has changed. There are many women involved now, and that's progress for sure. And a few more people of color. But to get through to if you approach people sometimes They don't want to hear it. They don't want to listen to you. They don't want you to step in and do anything and actually put up barriers. How do you deal with that in a community?
So I think this is, I don't think the people you've described are any different than any human being. The person we're least aware of is ourselves. And what I mean by that is when somebody gives us information that makes us uncomfortable, we're not aware, because we're not self-aware, that the information's making us uncomfortable. But what we do is we try to push it away so you don't have to feel uncomfortable anymore. So when somebody from the outside, as you described it, comes to those in government and says there's a different way to do this, the people in government aren't self-aware, but not because they're in government, but because we're human beings and we're not often self-aware, that they do things a certain way because it makes them feel safe. And somebody from the outside trying to do something differently makes us feel self-doubt and insecure. So the person from the outside, if they want to be heard, first needs to put yourself into their shoes and say, how can we discuss this together? Instead of me telling them that they're wrong, which will inevitably cause a response of, no, you're wrong, when what's really happening is it's not even an argument about who's right and who's wrong. It's a way to deflect information that's making us feel uncomfortable and thus insecure about the way we've always operated and whether that was right or wrong in the first place. And so you come from it, if you come from it and you're wrong and I'm right, or this is something different, we have to do this, you're going to get obstruction. But I think you're going to get that not just in politics. You're going to get that in many places in life because we are not, at least not as Americans, I can't tell you about humans in general, but as Americans, we're not self-aware of where our motivations come from and why we do what we do. And so as a result, when something different comes by, it makes us feel nervous because we're starting to realize we don't know why we do what we're doing, and that doesn't make us feel comfortable.
Well, it seems to me that a lot of the changes that we're trying to make in this country, not just in this community, is to change that power base of white people. And white people, I think, especially I've found white women over the years, very, very inclusive, not very supportive of one another. In fact, almost the opposite. Whereas you have communities like Black communities, Latino communities that are very, very inclusive with one another. And so I think white people need to learn from some of these other groups of people about how to be unified, how to be loyal, how
So
to be supportive.
here's where it gets difficult, right? I'll go back to my human rights campaign story. I'm not LGBTQ. Yet the human rights campaign called me and said, we want to hire you. And I told them I'm not gay. And what did they say? 10% isn't 50%. We need more of you. Well, they concluded, I think, they needed more of me because the way to help cisgender, heterosexual, whatever word you want to use, comfortable with equality was sadly having to hear it from somebody who belonged to their class or their clique, i.e. me, right?
Sure.
And at least the Human Rights Campaign concluded that having only LGBTQ people telling non-LGBTQ people that LGBTQ people needed equality was not the way to break through with non-LGBTQ people. So if you're looking for Anglos or whites to understand and to appreciate equality from a non-white perspective, I think the message, I don't think Human Rights Campaign said it had to come exclusively from heterosexual people, but that it has to come from a different groups of people, not just the group that you're talking about. It needs to come from a coalition of people, including people who come from their group. And I think in some ways, that's why the Human Rights Campaign, or let me forget the Human Rights Campaign, LGBTQ, Helen, think about this. When we met in 2006, do you think we'd be talking about equal marriage in America? in 2019
No,
or even
I
2015
didn't.
when it happened? Did you ever in a million years think that was going to happen?
No, I
No.
just hoped it
Right.
would.
I never thought of it. We were just trying to kill off a marriage amendment in Indiana in 06 and 07. Who would have thought? But the point is, what the LGBTQ community deserves all the credit for is it did outreach beyond its own community and found allies beyond its own community and then embraced allies from outside its own community to be spokespeople for equality for the LGBTQ community. That wasn't easy. But
No, it
I'll
wasn't
tell
easy at all.
you and I are friends. You never questioned my commitment. The community, I'm honored for what the LGBTQ community has done for me, because the LGBTQ community never questioned my commitment, even though ostensibly I did not come from your group. Your group understood that it isn't about your group. That even though I'm not LGBTQ, it's our group. That Stu Rosenberg, not only does he understand it, but we really believe it. We all believe it. That if LGBTQ does well, Stu, the white heterosexual male, will do well as well. So if he wants to be part of this, we're going to welcome him with open arms. That's how I think you reach out to. You're right. Let's be serious. I am the least open-minded demographic in America. Right? I'm a middle-aged white heterosexual male. So if you're going to try to persuade a white heterosexual male, part of your coalition is going to have to include white heterosexual males. Not exclusively be white heterosexual males, but will have to be a part of it. And in the case of the LGBTQ community, they saw that. You saw that in me, and I'm forever in the debt to the community for never questioning my commitment and for embracing people and for embracing allies. So I can't thank you enough for that. And I think it was the embracing of allies that was the huge pivot point to changing the way this country thinks about LGBTQ.
Well, yeah, and it should be obvious to people that it worked, that this is what we need. And of course, we need sincere people. I mean, you're a sincere person. And I think that comes across as well. You're not just out there politicizing and activating people just for some kind of self-aggrandizement. You're sincere in the issues that you fight for and the people that you fight for. So I think that comes across. So, I mean, we're in your debt as well. What scares me kind of a little bit now is that all the different cities and states and judges and officials that are trying to overturn everything that we accomplished.
Oh, the fight is not over.
No,
Oh
it's
my
not.
gosh. The fight is not over. It's not even close. And I can't tell you, I've already given you some philosophy and psychology about the human mind, which you could agree or disagree with.
No, I agree.
I can't tell you if humanity is meant to be tribalistic, and that's where our natural proclivity is. But I can tell you this much, the fight is not over, and it's never going to be easy, and there will never be a day in our lifetimes at least where we can say we've achieved full equality and we've won and we need to stop fighting. Because the more things change in society, remember, change makes people afraid, and it makes people afraid because they've been able to live in a lack of self-awareness comfort bubble, and change threatens that comfort bubble because now they have to really ask themselves, is the way things have been really as good as it could have been? And that makes people anxious because if the answer is no, then you have to admit to yourself, I have not been living a full and correct and good life. If I've been living this life that, as it turns out, was not as good as it should have been and been happy with it, that makes people uncomfortable. So this is always going to be a struggle, but it's a struggle worth fighting for.
Oh yes, we can't give up. That's why I'm still speaking out in one way or another.
We cannot give up, and we just need to some of your earlier questions, we need to identify those who are uncomfortable with a new reality but could be open to it based on the right coalitions and the right messages and the right sincerity, and those who unfortunately cannot, who literally, no matter what coalition you have, no matter who the message is from, no matter what the message is, no matter how it's delivered, will never change. They can't overcome their own insecurity to consider change. And you need to, it's hard to figure out who's those who can and who those who can't, but that's always a struggle, and you keep on working to try to figure that out. And those who can, you work with, and those who can't, you have to shrug your shoulders and say, we're never all going to agree on the same thing all the time.
Progress is never easy,
No, it isn't.
especially on really, really serious issues. What are you going to be doing in the next couple of years? I know we have a major election coming up in a couple of years, and I know that you work constantly. Are there any particular campaigns or areas that you're going to be focused on?
So I'm going to be focusing on state legislative races in states where one or both branches can flip to the Democrats where they're currently with the Republicans. And the reason for that, and this isn't all I'm going to do, but this will be my primary focus. The reason for that is by gaining more Democratic seats and flipping a branch of the legislature, if not both, allows you to have more of a seat at the table in the deliberations, including a very important one, which is redistricting boundaries. And so I'll give you an example. In the state of Kansas, they have a Democratic governor. They're in the super minority in both the House and the Senate, but by only one seat in the House and three seats in the Senate. So right now, whenever the governor vetoes a piece of bad Republican legislation, if the Republicans all decide to vote together, they can override every one of the governor's vetoes, making the governor, frankly, a lot less powerful in ability to do things. You flip two House seats in that state house and make it so it's not they're not in the super minority anymore, and she vetoes something. If all the members of the Democratic House stay together, the veto gets upheld, and now suddenly the Democrats have a seat at the table in Kansas government in a way that they don't have today. That would be an example of something I'm going to try to work on for 2020.
And actually, Kansas has always been pretty much a red state. I went to high school in Kansas City, and I grew up in New York City, but then we moved, and it's a long story. But anyway, and Kansas has always been pretty conservative, I know.
But they just elected a Native American lesbian Democrat to Congress.
Yes, absolutely. I do see progress. Well, I have a lot of friends still there that I talk to occasionally, and they're all Democrats. But they've felt like they've been in the minority for a long time.
Well, here's their chance. If we can win back a couple state house seats or four or five state senate seats, and the maps are drawn so that your Democratic friends aren't all packed into one district, thus they can't really influence a state house or state senate election, the state will become less right-wing crazy the way it has been under the previous governor and the secretary of state who ran for governor. So there's opportunities in places like Kansas. And so I'm looking for states where a few seats here and a few seats there can actually make a huge amount of difference at the state level. Because I mentioned before about Foundation Blue, where people's lives are ch changed most dramatically is on the municipal and state level. It's not on the federal level. So a few state house races in Kansas, of all places, could make a whole lot of difference for a whole lot more people than 3 to 5 more congressional seats in the U.S. House.
So, what other states are you focused on? I know that you're talking about Indiana. You've been talking about Indiana.
Indiana has always intrigued me because Indiana, as you know, we killed the marriage amendment there in 06 with shoestrings and duct tape. Then it was
Right.
killed again in 11 when it was well financed because people then realized Indiana could be beaten back. I believe this is, 2020 isn't the governor year, obviously, But I think the residents of Indiana are starting to get a little annoyed. And I believe there's some state legislative seats and some municipal races that you flip a few of them with an eye towards a bigger move in 2022. So find some places where you can engage in good practices, engage in good grassroots organizing in a sophisticated way, communicate in a way where we're telling our personal story instead of being, I think you put it snobby was the word you put it earlier.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Instead of being snobby and just using DC talking points and saying, you know, like Hillary Clinton, Hillary Clinton ran a presidential race and literally advertised to people, you'd have to be an idiot to vote for this racist, sexist, homophobic scumbag. And guess what people heard from that? Are you calling me an idiot? There's ways. Like, I believe we can start engaging in good practices in Indiana in 19 and 20 to allow for us to have a bigger chance. Again, remember, ground up, we do a few good races in 19 and 20. We can use this as a foundation to try to get rid of the governor you have in 2022. And this is going to be like Nevada. This is not going to happen overnight, right? This is not an overnight thing for Indiana. But why do we help get J.D. Ford elected? Why did I help do some TV commercials for J.D. Ford? Because either, as Senator Tammy Baldwin said, either you have a seat at the table or you're on the menu. And for the first time, the LGBTQ community has a seat at the table in the state legislature. Sometimes all it takes is one seat to make a significant difference in policy in a local or state level. He'll help.
Don't you think one of the approaches is that I do hear a lot of rumblings about how Indiana is losing jobs or they're not drawing corporations and various companies that could really boost the economy because we don't have a hate crimes bill. And there are companies that don't want to come to a state that doesn't seem to support all of its citizens and therefore all of its employees. And I think that's something that's kind of done some damage to the economy here. And I do hear people talking about that.
Absolutely. And so not only is that a good message, but the question becomes, who's the messenger? And this is what I mean is, there are companies in Indiana, and God bless them, who are actually willing to say what you just said out loud. And if it's the companies saying this, then the message might get heard better than if it's you or I saying it or a candidate saying it. And this is what I mean about ongoing interaction and engagement. If we did more, because we did, you might remember in 2006 how we did a lot of corporate outreach.
Yes.
To try to defeat the anti-marriage amendment. Was our campaign solely on corporate outreach? Of course not. But it wasn't us saying to legislators and to voters, oh, but you're losing business because you don't have a hate crime. No, it was businesses saying, we don't like it here because of this. This is not helping us grow our business and create jobs for folks in Indiana. And that there was more, this might be about authenticity. Who's the more authentic message? The actual business person or business that's getting impacted by lack of a hate crime or you or me? In this case, it's the business. And there are businesses who are willing to say these things. And if they say these things now, then when the campaign happens and a candidate says, I'm for a hate crime bill because we need to create more jobs in Indiana and this will do so, it doesn't sound like a talking point because people have heard from the actual businesses well before the election that this was an issue.
Actually, the governor, Holcomb, was kind of saying that same thing that I think, you know, because Indiana really wanted to bring Amazon here. And he mentioned that we really needed a hate crimes bill because we were losing a competitive edge on the, you know, professional and corporate level in competition with other states and other cities. And then, of course, they watered down the hate crimes bill. It had to include Christians. I think Holcomb wasn't going to support that bill, and it just kind of died out again.
Yep.
But I was surprised. I mean, I'm not a big fan of Holcomb. He's better than Pence, in my opinion, by far.
That's not saying much.
No, it's not. It's not at all. I was surprised that he came out for that. I thought, well, it's an economic issue, but that makes sense. A governor should be concerned about the economy of their state.
I mean, but it's going to take a while. But it needs to be an ongoing conversation, not just during election season. Obviously, Holcomb was willing to say what he said when it was not during election season. But if the coalition stayed together, and worked with a broad-based coalition, which means corporations as well, sometimes business isn't bad. Sometimes business is good. In this case, there are businesses in Indiana that have always been pro-equality publicly, helping to beat back bad bills and help positive bills. And I think we've got progress to be made in Indiana, but guess what? Let's find a few of the bigots who are in the state legislature right now, like Mike Delf, and let's get them out of there. That's what we did with JD.
I would like to see people stand up to some of these companies that we do have here that are very bigoted. And that would be a Hobby Lobby for one and Chick-fil-A. I think it doesn't demonstrate to your population that you are supporting equality when you either allow these businesses or you support them.
So there's no reason you can't do both. Name a business that is good. I mean, I know a few, but name a business that's good.
Sure. Well, Eli Lilly, for sure. They're huge.
Right?
They've always been
Comments.
supportive.
But there's also, you mentioned Chick-fil-A and Hobby Lobby.
And Cummins and Eli Lilly.
Isn't Target pretty good on LGBTQ stuff?
They, yes and no. Yes, they are. I think they are overall.
But the
There
point
has
is, find the good ones, find the competitors of the bad ones. And don't just say, don't do the bad ones. Say, do the good ones. If you want to eat fast food, here's a couple of fast food places we all should go to. We should say, not only should we say shame for those who deserve to be told shame, but we should say thank you for those who deserve to say thank you. We deserve a little gratitude, a thank you. Yes, maybe you could argue doing the right thing you shouldn't be deserving gratitude for because it's the right thing. But it never hurts to be nice. It never hurts to
No,
say
it
thank
doesn't.
you. And yes, I bet there's an alternative to Hobby Lobby to go to get whatever it is you're looking to get to. And if you did that, then companies not only see, we shouldn't be bad, but they can say, we might actually get extra rewards for being good.
That's very, very hopeful, positive attitude. I like that attitude. I tell people all the time certain places that I will not spend my money because to me, you should not spend your money where they don't support you or well, they would actually discriminate against you, or in some cases, just want you to be gone, period.
Well, okay,
And
do me a favor. Pick your three businesses right now that you tell people please don't ever go to. Hobby Lobby, Chick-fil-A, what's your third?
actually, Walmart's one of them too
Okay.
that I have a struggle with.
All right. Well, that's more of a struggle. I'd say don't do that. I'll give you another one. Don't go to Domino's Pizza.
No, I don't. That's true. I don't.
They're anti-choice. Don't do Domino's Pizza. All right. There's four right there. What we ought to be able to do, and I can't do it. And I'm embarrassed I can't. Is a name four right now? We said, oh, yeah, you definitely should shop there. The fact that we can't do that is shame on me. Shame on me that I can't do that.
Yeah, I'm not positive about some of them. I figure some of the big stores like Macy's and Saks and all those, I'm not sure that they discriminate. Although Macy's came under fire, what, back in the 30s and 40s for being very fascist, and so I'm not sure
But
that
there's,
you know that.
so let me point to somebody, to whoever's listening here, go to the Human Rights Campaign scorecard. They actually do a scorecard of businesses that are pro-equality, not pro-equality, and they have a scorecard. The fact that I haven't reviewed the HRC scorecard recently to know four businesses I should definitely shop at, that's shame on me. So let me do a plug. I don't work the Human Rights Campaign anymore, but I think the scorecard's a valuable scorecard. It's an easy
Yes,
way
it
to
is.
find out companies that are good. But one thing we often do when we're trying to be advocates is we try to find things that are bad. Like, in other words, we punish bad people, but don't reward good people enough. So, you know what? After this call, I'm going to look at the Human Rights Campaign scorecard. I'm going to find four businesses I'm going to go shopping at.
Well, I think I'll probably do that too now. Actually, I used to watch that scorecard quite a bit, and I suppose since I've retired, I kind of don't as much. But I've been getting, I mean, ever since we've had number 45 as president, I mean, I've just been in shock. And
Angry, right? We're angry.
yes, not just surprised, you know, because I know that there are people out there who think the way his supporters think. I know that. I live around them because I'm here in Indiana. But I've just been shocked at the level of meanness and nastiness and rudeness and the lack of knowledge about what he's even doing.
Well, but here's the other thing. This is where we is that sometimes as Democrats, we believe that we know what's best for how people should spend their time. And what I mean by that is, yes, there may be plenty of people out there who aren't as civically engaged or as informed as the chattering class, of which I'm probably one. But that doesn't mean they're evil, and it doesn't mean they're stupid, because who am I to tell somebody how they should spend their time? If they want to spend their time working three jobs to support their family, who am I to say they should be spending more time be learning about what's going on in public policy instead of doing that? If they want to spend their time focusing on who the Indianapolis Colts are going to be playing next year and whether they can finally have the talent to do more than just make the playoffs, who am I to tell them, to tell people who decided to prioritize their time in the Indianapolis Colts that they're stupid, they're ill-informed? Like, you're not going to persuade anyone on anything by implying or explicitly saying they're uneducated, ill-informed, etc.
Or
Instead,
calling them deplorables.
we're calling them deplorables because they're not, like, now again, there's some people, I'm not saying there aren't people who will never be convinced about our view of equality. I'm not saying that. But there are some, in other words, there are some people who voted who by being called deplorables and were told you had to be an idiot to vote for Trump, did so not because they agreed with Trump, but because they didn't like being called idiots. And my point
Yes.
being is, if we keep on calling people idiots, then they will continue to not support the causes we believe in. Not because they may not support our causes, but because we're calling them idiots. And we often do this, like, oh, if we just educated the electorate more. And I'm like, wait a minute, who made you God as to what people need to know and when they need to know it? Point is, find where they are. If they're going to Indianapolis Colts games and that's what they care about, maybe that's where my digital advertising is helpful. Because we do digital advertising to people who like the Indianapolis Colts, if that turns out to be an audience you want to hit. So they're already on a web page reading about the Indianapolis Colts and they see an advertisement on something else, and that's where they are. Right? There's ways to reach them other than just calling them idiots. And I'm not saying you were calling them idiots, but I am saying as
No, exactly.
Democrats, we sometimes do call voters idiots in ways like literally calling them deplorables, which is explicit, or another way saying, if we just educated the voters, that's just a different way of calling somebody an idiot. And it's not helpful. It's just not helpful.
So what we have to try to do is be positive, friendly, and open at all times. You don't have to accept people for what they believe, but you have to accept them for being people. Being part of our population and part of our communities, and it's hard sometimes when people come across with really bigoted views or nastiness. It's really hard to remain being nice. I was raised to be nice to people. I was raised in a political family, and it's even for me, I'll come home, you know, and say all sorts of things, but I try to always treat people respectfully. And I think that's all about unity and coming together.
Yeah, well, my argument would be if a bigot calls you a name to your face, They're never
That's right.
happy with you. And if for your own purposes, you choose to punch him in the nose or walk away, that's your own decision. Okay? But just make sure the person you've chosen to punch in the nose has actually said something bigoted instead of said something out of anger because you've done something or you've done something inadvertently or something has been done from an outside source that's causing this to happen.
Sure.
There are
Yeah, that's
plenty of bigots in this world we are never going to persuade, but there are others who are just afraid of what is going on and they don't know why. They don't know how to handle it. And having a conversation with that person by saying, "Well, you're an idiot," will probably cause them to say something back to you that's probably not going to be very nice. And it might even be bigoted. But you
it's
don't. You know, calling somebody an idiot does not usually lead to a nice response.
No, it's usually it's nice to try to reach people and make them understand how much better we would be if we all, not necessarily all agree on everything, but come together and support one another. I think that's what we have to convince people to
And
do,
then
and
the
that
bigots will
takes a
be
lot of
isolated.
work.
And the bigots will be isolated, and the bigots can be bigots. And okay,
Right,
but
exactly.
you know.
Well, Stu, it's been great talking with you and hearing your opinion and where you're coming from on all these issues. I'd like to talk again closer to the next election in 2020. It'd be great. And I assume you're probably going to be around Indiana a little bit, so
I
maybe
will
we'll
be.
see each other.
But let me make one modification of that. You should also have me on your program right before the municipal elections in Indiana.
Yes, that'd be a good idea.
Right?
Good idea. Yes.
That's one way that we get people more engaged in municipal elections is by having conversations about elections other than right before an even year election.
That's right. So we'll schedule you in. So
Sounds good.
I'm gonna let you go back to your nice, peaceful, romantic weekend. And and thank you very much to your partner or girlfriend for understanding.
Oh, she's very supportive, so don't worry. She's
Good.
thrilled we're doing this.
And we'll talk to you again soon.
All right, thanks. Thanks so much.